This is the second morning of the retreat, and hopefully that you're beginning to settle down and settle into the meditation schedule. Again, be very gentle with yourself, not to push yourself too hard, because the sort of effort required for such a meditation retreat is the efforts of someone running a marathon, not someone running a sprint. So you have to pace yourself, and it's the quality of meditation is much more important than the quantity of meditation. So constantly throughout this retreat you should be looking at the state of your mind and the state of your body, and if you find that there's tension arising in the body, headaches and aches and pains, it means you're pushing yourself too hard. So you can take yourself out for a walk, or you could relax a bit more, have a cup of tea, or just sit down and just, as I say, watch the trees grow. Do something very simple. Because that degree of relaxation is important. I mentioned yesterday, in passing, the concept of playtime. And what playtime is for children at school is that when you are having to work so hard, learning new things, studying, if you don't have that playtime, just the mind just gets very dull. It just needs a bit of time out just to enliven it, encourage it, and then you find it's much more pliable afterwards. And in the same way, during this meditation retreat, if you find you need playtime, then just go out and have a nice walk and just go and watch the ocean or something. Only need about 10 or 15 minutes playtime. And then when you take your body and mind back in here afterwards, you find it's more easy to meditate. It's more easy to make the mind still and peaceful. The point is that the mind needs happiness. Eventually that happiness will just come from the process of meditation itself. But until that time, sometimes we need to feed it some happiness just to encourage it, even from outside. But the point that the mind needs happiness is one of the basic understandings which provide success in your meditation. I did mention to you yesterday that the reason why a person can watch the television for long periods of time is because they're enjoying what they're experiencing. In the same way, the meditation works if you start to develop that joy in what you're doing, the joy in what you're experiencing. Whatever stage of the meditation, it's important to find the happiness and joy in it. So look for the beauty in it. And if one can start to develop what I call the perception of beauty in whatever you're doing, then you can find a lot of happiness and a lot of success in your lives. Instead of being a person who develops fault finding, you develop the perception of the beautiful. And that perception of the beautiful is not hard to attain. Once you understand what perception is, and that it actually affords you a great deal of choice, if we only knew how to take it, then we could actually have some more control over our minds. What I mean by the choice in perception is a simile of the supermarket shelf. The supermarket might be selling many different forms of breakfast cereal. But why is it, those of you who go shopping, you go to just the type of cereal you always eat, the same brand, even the same size. Even though there's many other breakfast cereals there, you automatically choose one. Even though there may be something else might be cheaper, or might be better, or might be more delicious. We're creatures of habit. In the same way, on the shelf of perception, you have many different things which you can see, which you can choose to present to consciousness. But very often we only choose the same old products which we always choose. If we get into the habit of thinking meditation is hard and difficult, that when we go onto that shelf in our mind, we'll always be picking out the perception, meditation equals hard, meditation equals difficulty. It's my job as a teacher is to widen your choice on the supermarket shelf of perceptions, to see that right next to that product, difficult meditation, tough meditation, hard meditation, right next to it is another product Brahms happy meditation. And to take that one instead. Because all you have to do is to have fun with this meditation. Whether it's the present moment, actually look upon it with joy and with happiness. The point is, the happiness is there. You're not inventing something, you're not manufacturing something which isn't really part of the experience. It's just a different way of looking at it. It's like I was telling people, even like going to the dentist. Many people are afraid of going to the dentist. Why are they afraid of going to the dentist? Because that's what you're supposed to be afraid of, going to the dentist. It's that conditioning, isn't it? When I go to the dentist, it's wonderful. I really enjoy going to the dentist because, first of all, the chairs in the dentist surgery are much more comfortable than anything I can sit on in the monastery. And secondly, with all those things in my mouth, I can't say anything. I can shut up for a while and enjoy myself. No one can ask me a question. So what I'm saying is there are some happy perceptions there, which I can take if I really want to. Or you can take the miserable perceptions, the painful perceptions. Both are there to be taken. It's up to you which ones you want to focus on. The meditation, you can start to think, oh my God, here comes another day, this is going to hurt, I know it's going to hurt. This is really, what did I do this for anyway? It's too embarrassing, you know, to go home now and now I've paid for 8 days. Or whatever else it is. You can develop those perceptions and you get really unhappy. Or you can develop a wonderful perception. Look, like I was saying yesterday, you're free from so much problems and difficulties. You don't have to sort of talk with people and argue with them. You don't have to live up to somebody's expectations. You don't have to meet quotas and deadlines. You're free from so much in this retreat. Isn't this wonderful? Isn't this lovely? All you have to do is sit here. You don't have to sit here for the whole hour. You know that the schedule on the board, there is only guidelines. If it starts to hurt you, uncomfortable, get up and do something else. It's wonderful. This is freedom. It's not like, you know, having to get up in the morning and get to work by a certain time. It's not having to cook the meal. You don't even have to cook anything. All you have to do is eat. Isn't it marvelous? So when you start to develop the beautiful perception, this meditation retreat is just lovely. You know, I really look forward to meditation retreats. I have such a nice time. And this is not work for me, this is holiday time. And with that perception, whenever I start meditation, the mind actually leaps towards the meditation. Whoopee, meditation, great, here we go. And once you have that attitude, you're actually looking for the happiness in every stage of meditation. And if you look for it, it's there. You start to look for the happiness. What is the happiness in the present moment? Why is the present moment happiness? Look for it, see if you can see it. And once you can see it, you start to value it, you appreciate the present moment is lovely. Where on earth have I been worrying about the past and the future all my life? When right here is the pot of gold. There's an old story about this is a Muslim story. There's an old story about this, Sufi story, sorry. This old monk, or Sufi monk, who lived in the forest. He lived there for a couple of years and he depended upon his alms from this very poor family who just had a couple of fields. But he was a very simple monk, didn't need very much. And then after a couple of years, the old Sufi monk said, well, you know, I've been here long enough now. It's about time I left. And of course the family had grown to love this old holy man. And said, oh, please, venerable sir, please stay. He said, no, it's, you know, I've got to go now. But he said, you've looked after me so well, I want to give you a gift. He said, I know you're very poor. Now this is what I want you to do. Tomorrow morning, at dawn, stand at the front of your house, face the rising sun, take the bow and arrow in your hand, and where the arrow falls, there you'll find great riches. And of course this was a Sufi, a monk, who would never lie. So this man thought, I'm a rich man. And that afternoon the monk left, and the following morning he and his wife were up very early, took the bow and arrow in their hands, and they stood at the door of their house, just waiting for the sun to rise. And as soon as the sun rose, so as they faced in that direction, he put the arrow in the bow, fired it, and then where it fell, they rushed with a spade and went digging, digging, digging. And after a while, a rich man came with his friends and said, "What are you doing digging in my field?" He said, "You're arrested." He said, "No, you don't understand." He said, this holy man, that Sufi monk, told me that where this arrow falls, that there I'll find a great treasure." And of course, this owner of the land, owner of the field, also knew that Sufi monk. He said, "This guy doesn't lie. So I'll help you dig, and we'll split the proceeds 50-50. And they dug and dug and dug. They couldn't find anything. And the rich man thought, "You know the problem? The problem is because you probably didn't follow the instructions properly. You don't know how to shoot an arrow. Come tomorrow morning. We'll go over it again. And I'll shoot the arrow this time." So the following morning, the family and this rich man stood at the door of this man's house. And at dawn, the rich man this time shot the arrow. And it went much further this time. And they dug where it fell. And after a little while, the general came with his troops and arrested them. "This is my field. What are you doing digging this hole here?" And they said that the story. And the general said, "So if you're all fools, you don't know how to shoot an arrow. Come tomorrow morning, I'll shoot the arrow. And where it falls, we'll split it three ways." And of course, the following morning, this time the general took the arrow, the bow and arrow, and shot it, went a great distance, because he was a general, a soldier. And then all of them together went to where the arrow fell, and they dug this huge hole, and they couldn't find anything. When the king came along and arrested all of them, he said, "That's the king's field. You're all going to be arrested." And when he arrested them all, so that he asked what was going on, and the king had faith in this Sufi monk. The king was a bit wise as well. He said, "Look, there's something strange going on here. No one can fire an arrow as far as the general. Why can't they find the treasure?" So he arrested them all and put them in jail, and then sent some other soldiers to go and find that monk and bring him to the palace to question him. And after a few days, they found that monk and they brought him to the palace. And the king asked him, said, "Why were you lying? First, the owner of the house shot the arrow and couldn't find anything. Then the rich man couldn't find anything. Then a general. They all got into trouble. Sort of, what's wrong here? Are you lying? They haven't found any trace. They've only found trouble." And the monk said, "Because they never followed instructions." And the monk said, "Your Highness, you come with me tomorrow morning to the poor man's house and bring the other people along as well, and I'll show you." And so the following morning, the king as well, very intrigued, went to the poor man's house with the rich man and the general and with the monk. And at dawn, the monk repeated the instructions. So at dawn, sort of, stand at the front of your house. Face the rising sun with your bow and arrow, and where the arrow falls, there you'll find a great pot of gold. Now follow those instructions. And the king put the arrow in the bow and was about to shoot. The man said, "I never said shoot the arrow. I said where the arrow falls. Drop the arrow." And the king dropped the arrow and it fell between his feet, right at the threshold. "Dig there." And they dug there and it was a great pile of gold. But the Sufi monk said, "But it's not just a pile of gold which is the treasure I'm talking about. Why is it we always fire our arrows of desire somewhere outside over there, over further, even further, when the treasure lies right here?" So that's a little Sufi story about our happiness, instead of looking somewhere else, the happiness is right here. So don't shoot the arrow somewhere else, into jhanas, into enlightenment, it's somewhere else. It's here you'll find the jhanas, it's here you'll find enlightenment. It's right here where you're standing, you'll find all the happiness there is. So that happiness is here. So you just have to develop that perception of happiness in the present moment. You don't need to shoot the arrow to the past or the future to find happiness. You have as much happiness as you could ever want right in this moment. You can only perceive it that way. So this is training perception on the present moment awareness. Isn't it wonderful to be in this little centre here, just away from the city, next to the ocean, a lovely sunny day? Even those of you who have got hay fever and sniffing and sick, isn't this better? I mean, you could be dead instead. At least you're alive. At least you're sniffing. If you weren't sniffing, that would be a big trouble. So whatever it is, you can put the perception and be grateful for what you have. Grateful for this moment. Grateful for this time. Otherwise, if you don't make use of this time, you'll feel so regretful afterwards. That's actually what happens to many people at the end of their life. They regret how much time they wasted being somewhere else when life was happening. That's why for many people the time seems to go so quickly, because they're never really here when it's happening. As a child, you were always in the present moment. That's why time seemed to go very slowly. The thing is that you're either here experiencing it, or you're somewhere else, and that's why it's gone. So be here and experience this moment, and it's so much happiness and so much fun. However, the ignorance, the delusion, seems to tell us that in the next moment it will be fun. That's why that when I was a young man, one of the reasons I became a monk was because I started getting disillusioned with the way of the world. The way of the world, some of you have heard me tell the story before, the way of the world was this: when I was about 15, doing my O-level examinations, as the first serious examinations you did in the English school system, that I liked to go out with my mates playing soccer in the park. But my parents and my teachers told me, said, look, stay at home, do your homework, study hard, and then you pass these very important examinations and then you'll be happy. And so I took their advice. So I stopped going out with my mates down the local park playing soccer, and I stayed home and did my homework and studied, and I did very well in my O-level examinations. And what happened next was, if you pass one exam, you got another one to come afterwards. So I had to do the A-level examinations, the next level. So it happened the same again. This time I wasn't playing soccer, you were chasing the girls. And the parents and the teachers said, look, don't go out chasing the girls. Stay at home, do your homework, study, and then when you pass your examinations, you know, A-levels, then you know, life is open to you. You'll be happy. You'll be rich. So I followed that advice. You did very well at the A-level examinations. More exams, university. And I heard the same thing there. He said, look, don't go out to too many parties. Sort of, you know, stay at home, study a lot. Stay in your room. Don't get into any trouble. And then if you pass your examinations, if you really work hard and get a degree, then you may. Then you'll be happy. And this is where I started sort of questioning this. I saw people who had gone before me, who had finished their degree. Were they happy after their degree? They had to go to work to get save up some money. And they were going to work, working very hard, saving hard, thinking, when I've saved up enough money, then I'll be happy. But they had to get somewhere to live, so they get a little house, and they have to get a loan from the bank. And they work really hard. When I pay off the loan, then I'll be happy. Or they meet somebody and get married. And that's really putting forth a giving up happiness for a long time, because you have to get a bigger house together. You know, set up a house, because we work really hard, two incomes, and then, you know, 6 or 7 years we might pay off our little house and then we'll be happy, and then we can retire. But of course then you have babies. And that puts off your happiness for even more years. Because you always think, when the kids leave home, you know, when they're all sort of past their degrees or whatever, and they got their jobs, when they're left home, then we're free, then we can really enjoy each other's company, then we'll be happy. And by the time all this happens, by the time you've paid off your mortgage and the kids have left home, you're getting sort of 50-ish, so you start thinking, when I retire, only a few more years at my job, when I retire, then I'll be happy. It's true, isn't it? That's what a lot of people think. And when they do retire, they're so old now. That's when they start going to temples and churches. You know why? Because they think, when I die, then I'll be happy. Well, actually, that's life, isn't it, for many people? There's always this promise of happiness, but it's always, you know, a few years in front of us, sometime later. For many people, it's like that. And their happiness is always just distant from them. And they never find any real happiness. It's always, when something happens, then I'll be happy. So having seen that, I sort of think, that must be something wrong there. So I wanted to find out why life isn't happy now. And that's where you started to put happiness into whatever you're doing. So if I'm teaching a retreat, I put happiness into that, and I enjoy teaching retreats. If I'm giving a talk, I put happiness into that, so I enjoy giving a talk. You know, it's supposed to be one of the most frightening things to do, to do public speaking. The way to overcome that fear is enjoy it, put fun into it. Those people who are afraid of going to a dentist, put fun into it, enjoy it. And that way you're not afraid of anything in life. Not only that, but when it comes to meditation, the mind is not afraid of meditation. If you're not afraid of meditation, you don't go wandering off somewhere else. You're not afraid of the present moment. You're not afraid of yourself. Because that's where you live, you know. You don't live in the past and the future. Where you really are is now. And one of the reasons why people can't stay in the present moment is because they're afraid of themselves, not quite sure who they are or what they are, and so they'd rather fantasize or dream rather than come home and see themselves. But after a while, you can feel a lot of happiness in the present moment, a lot of sense of acceptance of yourself in the present moment. And with that sense of loving kindness towards the present moment becomes a very beautiful abiding. You're just being here. I said yesterday, why is it that people run away from the present moment? Why is it we think of the past or think of the future? Well, we don't have to. Meditation retreat is the last place we need to plan for the future or think of the past. Especially those of you who stay until Friday. Friday is such a long way off. So why do we even think or bother to wonder about what's going to happen when we finish this retreat? So meditation retreat is the last place we need to think of the past and the future. But why do we do so? It's just because we're afraid of the present. Why is it that we can't be silent? Because actually we're afraid of silence. It's threatening us. We're not used to it. So part of this retreat is getting used to present moment, getting used to silence. And it's my job to sort of do the marketing, to do the PR. Silence is really good. It's good for your health. It's great for your meditation. And with a bit of marketing and a bit of encouragement, you might buy the product. And if you buy the product, I guarantee that you'll enjoy it. And it's true, you do enjoy it. It's the nature of things, that silence and present moment is extremely beautiful and full of contentment. So when you're doing these stages of meditation, make sure that you actually look out for the beauty in these things. And see if you can see it. The beauty in being present, the beauty in silence. Once you can see that, that's called insight. That is a powerful insight. It's not an insight which will let you give a talk of the BSV or the nature of dependent origination. That's just mostly thinking. This is insight into a very deep truth, into how wonderful it is just to be. How beautiful it is to be silent and not to be bothered by irritating thoughts. And just how open is the world when we're silent. Once those insights start to come, the insights which make meditation easier and easier and easier. Once you really see that the present moment is fun, once you see the silence is beautiful, it's more beautiful than any symphony. Once you see that, then you'll always be inclining towards that silence. Always be inclining towards that present moment. Whenever you can, the mind will just go there. And you don't have to tell it, you don't have to force it. You just say, off you go. It's like telling your children to go and play video games. You don't need to force them. You need to force them to clean their room, but not to play games. Off you go, and the mind goes effortlessly, and you can stay there a long time. It's the same with the next stage of the meditation, with the breath. Sometimes people wonder, how on earth can you think that the breath is something beautiful and wonderful? But the point is that those who have done lots of meditation will know the breath is one of the most beautiful things in the whole universe. The breath is what links you to nature. The oxygen which you breathe in has come from the plants, from the trees, from the flowers. Who have absorbed the carbon dioxide, taken out the oxygen, given that out to you. The oxygen in which you breathe, on which your life depends, is a gift from all of the flowers and the trees and the bushes around you. And in return, you breathe out the carbon dioxide, which is the lifeblood of the flowers and the trees, to make the carbon compounds from which they grow. That's your gift to nature. Oxygen is nature's gift to you. This beautiful symbiosis of breathing, connecting you to the whole planet. Looking on it that way just makes the breath interesting. It makes it enjoyable. It makes it something much more wonderful than just a simple old breath. If you start to perceive the breath in that way, again, it's very enjoyable just to be with the breath. But the main reason why the breath becomes a very pleasant abiding is that it's because it's simple. Here, you're starting to perceive the beauty of simplicity. Life is so complex. It's full of so many problems. You build a house, and how many problems is there? You know, you buy a car, and you have to service it, you have to clean it. There's so many problems, having a car. You build a monastery. You become president of the BSV. There's so many problems with doing things. You know, you sort of have a husband. There's so many problems having a husband. Or wife, whatever. But isn't it wonderful to have something which is simple? Just being with a breath. The breath doesn't give you any problems at all. Or so few problems. In fact, all you need to do is just watch it, and it just does it by itself. So it's a marvellous way of letting go and being at peace with something extremely simple. So you're just watching the breath, being with the breath. Oh, gorgeous simplicity. Sort of letting go, getting away from the maddening world, just being with the breath. It's in simplicity which is the cause of its beauty and happiness. And that gives you a great insight if you can notice that. It actually will increase your level of simplicity in your life. You realize that all of the extra things you have in the house aren't inconveniences. This is just the marketing says it's modern conveniences. I call them modern troublemakers. They take up your time, don't they? Like computers, for example. All of you have got computers. Weren't they supposed to be time savers? And how much time do you actually have to spend on those things? So you see, the trouble with the world. When we want real convenience and freedom, we only get more trouble and less time. There's something we're not seeing. What we're not seeing is the beauty of simplicity. Okay, this is bad for the economy, I know, but it's great for people's health to have fewer things and to live more simply. And here you're actually experiencing that. Just in this meditation retreat, all you have to have is one breath. It's the only thing you need to concern about, to worry about. And just this one breath happening now, not the next breath, not the last breath, just this breath. And that gives you a lot of happiness. It's important when you start watching the breath to be able to see the happiness in the breath, the beauty in the breath. That's such an important stage in the meditation, and I've even called it a separate stage, the beautiful breath. So with the breath, I've actually split it up into three stages. After doing present moment awareness and deepening into silence and deepening that into perception of the breath, and then the whole breath, as I was saying last night, from the beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, that full awareness of the breath, then to develop the beauty in the breath. Actually, that those of you who know the suttas, that's part of Anapanasati. Breathing in, the meditator experiences happiness, sukha. Breathing out, he experiences happiness. Breathing in, she experiences rapture. Breathing out, she experiences rapture. Those are the fifth and sixth stages of the Anapanasati Sutta taught by the Buddha. It's developing the perception of the beauty, the happiness in the breath. I do that the fifth stage in my system. Once you've got the breath in mind, see its beauty. Now the important thing here is that this allows you to let go even more. Instead of holding on to the meditation object holds on to you. And the glue is the happiness. That's what allows you to remain with the object. Just the piti sukha, the happiness of the experience. And those of you who have got into reasonable deep meditation will know this is what occurs. You're sitting here and the breath is going in, breath is going out. You're very mindful, very aware. You don't have to do anything, just the breath stays. And you're very happy and very peaceful. It's a level of happiness which few people in this world appreciate. It's just the happiness of simplicity rather than the happiness of excitement. Once that happiness of simplicity starts to manifest, then you're on the road to deep meditation. Because if you're happy with being this simple, it's a suggestion to the mind, if I let go even more and become even more simple, perhaps I might become even happier, and you do. Once the breath starts to calm down, it gets happier. And this is that reinforcement which helps you get into this cycle of letting go, getting more happy, letting go even more, getting more happy, getting more bliss, getting more joy in the mind. That encourage you eventually to let go of the breath itself. You calm the breath down so much. It's not your calming the breath down, it happens naturally. As you calm down more and more and more and more, as more and more happiness comes in the mind. And you're having these beautiful meditations, the meditation where you have smiles on your face. The reason why you come, go back and say, I had a wonderful time in this meditation retreat. I had a happy time. It's a happiness of peace. As these are the next stages of the meditation. As the breath gets calmer and calmer and calmer, so I was saying last night at question time, that which is the sixth sense, the mind, starts to become prominent. The mind itself can be experienced by mindfulness, by awareness. However, the strange thing about the mind is we haven't got a language for it. Certainly not in English. In Pali, yes. But many of those words people don't understand until they get to that territory and recognize those features. That is why when the mind actually becomes manifest and we actually experience it, that we haven't got language to describe it. The language which we use, the way perception works, is we try and find the nearest experience in our ordinary life to what we're experiencing in the mind. That's what perception is, that's what naming is, comparisons. And the nearest experience is usually beautiful light, beautiful visions. However, it needs to be stressed again and again that when the mind manifests, what you are seeing is not a light. What you're seeing is the mind, which you interpret as a light. This is where we get to the realm of nimittas. Nimitta is a reflection of your mind. In the same way you look at your face in a mirror or in a pool of water, so here the mind is looking at the mind, reflecting itself. And this is how it sees itself, as a beautiful light. It does not matter what colour that light is, because that colour is your name, your interpretation. It's not part of the experience. One of the strange things about this state in meditation is that everyone sees the same thing. Only we give it different names and different interpretations. For example, some years ago, that one person in their retreat saw what she described as a beautiful blue blancmange. She said it's the most beautiful blue she'd ever seen in her whole life. And the stage of the meditation she was at that told me that was a dinky dye nimitta. She only called it a blancmange because it was shaking. And her perception said, what shakes is like a jelly, like a blancmange. And that's what she called it. So other people have called it, experienced the black nimitta. And they said they experienced blackness when the breath disappeared. But I asked them, what was it like? They said it was the most richest, deepest, most beautiful black, shimmering they've ever seen in their life. Not like a worldly blackness, but almost like a satin brilliant blackness. It's a nimitta. Exactly the same thing. You're just making it, giving it the name black or white or pink or whatever. It doesn't really matter what you call it. The point is the beauty and the attractiveness of it and the time when it arises. All that is just the mind interpreting the mind. And that's an important stage in the meditation. Because what this is actually showing you is that the five senses, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, have disappeared. They've calmed down. You've let go of them. This meditation is about letting go, isn't it? Now you've let go of a great deal. And the important thing with these nimittas is they're blissful. There's so much happiness and ecstasy there. In fact, that sometimes there's so much ecstasy and bliss, when these things first come up, they frighten people. And because they are frightening to some people, I like to talk about them even though people have not come close to experiencing them yet. There's no need to be afraid at all when these things happen. You're at the door to very wonderful states of mind. You're at the gateway to very deep and powerful insights. You're getting, as I was saying yesterday, close to the footprints of the Buddha himself. And the Buddha himself said, these are not to be feared. They're fearsome because they're so powerful. But it doesn't matter, you can take that ecstasy. You can take that bliss. Sometimes, quite literally, in meditation, sometimes you think you can't take any more bliss. But you can always take a bit more. And that's the perceptions which actually come up in your meditation. This is amazing, this is wonderful, wow. But you can't put those things in words. So you can take more bliss. And do you want some bliss? I'm sure you wouldn't mind a little bit of bliss. It's crazy, but when one comes up, you say, no, no, no. Be careful of that fear. In these stages of the meditation, there's two major obstacles. I've already mentioned one of them, fear. It's a bit too much. You're afraid, because it's powerful, it's blissful. But go into it, it's okay. And any monk who comes along and says you'll get attached to those blisses, you've got my permission to, I shouldn't really say this, kick them up the backside or something, but the Buddha said specifically, do not be afraid of those things, there's no danger there. And anyone who still has doubts, please come and see me when we get back to Bhīyasvīya and I'll show the passages from the suttas. There's everything to be gained here. Things like enlightenment. So please go for those. Don't be afraid. The other obstacle which comes up is just exhilaration. The wow response. At last, wow, this is it. After all these weeks, years, at last, jhanas. And of course, that wow response means they disappear straight away. And that's often a common response. For those people experiencing this, what usually happens is a beautiful nimitta, very powerful, and the wow response, you go right to it, right into it, and out of it again, and it's gone. It's just completely disappeared, and you're back almost at the beginning of your meditation, thinking, which is too much excitement. The simile, which will help you here, is Ajahn Chah's famous simile. It was even called the title of the book, but the person who wrote that simile didn't understand it and didn't actually give it its full meaning. The Still Forest Pool. The Still Forest Pool simile goes like this. There's a monk wandering in the jungles of Thailand. Ajahn Chah would always try, as all wandering monks would, try to get to a lake or a river by the mid-afternoon or late afternoon, so that he could bathe, get some water for drinking, and maybe wash a couple of robes, you know, which were soiled by sweat and dirt by walking all day in the tropical climate. And having washed, bathed, maybe drunk some water, then he would set up the mosquito net just a little bit away from the lake. And he said on many occasions he would sit there in his net just with his eyes open, and just watch the animals come to drink, which they did later on in the afternoon or evening. They'd only come out to drink if he was still and quiet. If they knew he was there, they'd be afraid. Jungle animals are more afraid of humans than humans are of them. So he had to be very still to watch his animals. He said sometimes he was extremely still. And when he was that still, some jungle animals came out, which were very shy indeed. And sometimes when he was perfectly still, some animals came out from the jungle whose names he didn't know. Wonderful, weird and strange animals who his parents and teachers had never told him existed. These were so shy that if they knew that even somebody was watching, they wouldn't come out. He said it was marvellous to be able to see such animals. And this was a simile for the jhanas, for nimittas. It's only when you're very, very still, sitting by the still forest pool, the old metaphor from time immemorial of the mind, the great lake inside. Sitting by that, watching. Only when you're very still do these amazing and wonderful things creep out from the jungle. But if they know you're watching, nimitta, then they go. They run away into the jungle. They don't come out for days afterwards. They know you're watching. So, when any of these stages come up, remember that simile, the still forest pool. Remember, if you want these things to last, if you really want to enjoy the presence of these wonderful things, you have to be so still that the nimitta doesn't even know you're watching. That's how still you need to be. So if it's a wow, that's it. The animals hear that and they all scuttle off again. Or if it's uh-oh, they hear that too and they're gone. So that's a metaphor which is very easy to remember and shows what you should do when these things happen. You know what you should do? Nothing. Sit still. Any doing is a movement, and any movement the animals perceive, and once they perceive it, they're off. Once these things start to manifest, it takes a lot of skill to be able to stay with things like nimittas and to be able to sustain your attention on it. And the skill in doing nothing. The skill in just being still, not moving, in the mind. This is where you really are practicing a very refined letting go, a very refined calmness. In this stage, you've already let go of the five senses. What you're letting go of now is what I call the doer. There's something inside of you which is always interfering. The doer. It's that which generates thought. It's that which starts plans. It's that which even starts to move your body to make you scratch or whatever. This is dua. The last thing you have to let go of is the doer. So you really are the silent watcher, the observer who doesn't respond. And all that doing, all that movement will cease. Once the doing ceases, the nimitta is absolutely still, then there will always be a sense of merging into that nimitta and getting even into a deeper state of bliss. And that will become for you a first jhana. Each of these different jhana states has got a different taste to it, a different degree of bliss. And here you're just experiencing just what happiness is. Meditators will know that the happinesses which you get from those stages would exceed anything you've ever experienced in your whole life in terms of pleasure. Sheer pleasure. So this is what makes the meditation extremely fascinating and interesting. And you ask yourself, why is this a path of pleasure? Because it's a path of ending suffering. Why are people monks and nuns? Because they know a pleasure which is even more delicious than any pleasures in the world. So this is actually giving you some great deep insights into the meaning of Sangha. It's the meaning of renunciation. Sometimes people in the West think you're celibate because there's something weird about you. Or they think you can't really be celibate in this world. You're messing around sort of when people aren't watching. But that's not the case. That celibacy of a monk or a nun is based on the deep meditations, if it's going to last. And you can experience those same things for yourself. The bliss of freedom. But also, what you're experiencing by getting into these deep states, the last thing you have to let go of is the doer. One of the reasons why this is quite frightening for some people is because we identify so much with the doer, it's as if we're giving up ourselves. That's actually why that in other traditions, when they get into a first jhana, which they sometimes have done in the past, they will call it themselves disappearing and merging in a god or an ultimate. And anyone who's gone into those states can understand why they say those things. When the doer is gone and disappeared, you just can't do anything there. You're gone. And what you experience is something very powerful and beautiful, the most blissful, powerful experience of your life. And for those who believe in a god, of course, their perception will call it by that name. As Buddhists who know beyond that, you know that this is just a state of mind, that's all. But the important thing is that for many people, that you've gone, you've disappeared. This part of you which you really thought was essential, choice, doing, will, chaitanya in Pali, which is no longer there. And when you come out afterwards and the doing starts to reassert itself, you know that you've existed in a place where there's no doing. Shows you that the doer is not you. You're getting a deep insight into anatta and many other things as well. That's later on down the track. The point is that as you develop these different stages of letting go, you focus deeper and deeper in. Be careful what I said yesterday about the next stage. You don't go on to the next stage, you go into the next stage. Don't try and get rid of the breath so you can go and get the nimitta or go get jhanas. Stay with the breath. The nimitta will come from right in the center of the breath, from within it. Not to the left, not to the right of the breath. So you don't need to focus your attention anywhere else except right in the center of your breathing. The jhanas don't come outside of the nimitta, right from the very center of the nimitta. I said yesterday the simile of the lotus opening up leaf by leaf. The next leaf in order in the stages lies within the leaf which you can see right now. And the jewel in the heart of the lotus lies right in the center of all those petals. So you don't need to throw away this lotus, this present moment, this silence, this breath, or whatever else you're watching now. Keep your attention on this. Don't move away from it. Develop that contentment which gives you that sustained attention. And you'll find the whole lotus will open up and reveal all these jhanas in their natural course. The mistake people make is to move on to something else. And they throw everything away. Move in to the experience. Hold the experience you have now with happiness. And that happiness will deepen as you get more and more content. Do you know when you watch a television? I use television similes because it's one of the normal experiences of concentration people have. You may have a pot plant on top of your television. You may have magazines underneath. But do you notice that when you watch the television, after only a few seconds, you're not aware of the pot plant anymore on top? Nor are you aware of the magazines underneath, they've all disappeared. You don't even know whether the screen is oblong or diamond or round. Even if you had a round screen on your television, after a while you wouldn't notice it. Because everything on the edges disappears. And that's why a television gives you the illusion of reality, because you can't see the pot plant which tells you that's just the television, just the screen. You forget it's a screen. You can't see its edges. Your attention is actually on the middle. You don't notice that the pot plant has disappeared. That's not part of your attention. In the same way in meditation, when things start to disappear, you don't know they've disappeared. It's only afterwards you realize you weren't aware of the body. You weren't aware of even breath. Just aware of the center of the screen. In the same way, there's a Hindu analogy of meditation. And it's the analogy of the three students who were taught meditation by means of archery. And having been taught about one-pointedness of mind, concentration, just being on one thing, sustaining attention there. One day the master wanted to test his students, and he gave a bow and arrow to the first student. He put a stuffed bird on a tree a long distance away and told the first student that he had to shoot the bird through the left eye of the bird. Not the right eye, not the head, not the body, but the left eye. And the only way he could do this, he could concentrate and make himself one with the target. And the master said, you have as much time as you want to focus on that left eyeball of that stuffed bird until you're ready to shoot. But the master said, before you shoot, just give me a sign. I want to ask you a question before you let the arrow go. And after half an hour of intense concentration, the student said he was ready. And the master said, can you see the bird on the tree still? He said, yes. And the master pushed him away, you stupid student. Go do some more meditation. And he gave the bird out to the second student. The same instructions, make yourself run with a target. You've got to shoot this bird through the left eyeball, nothing, nowhere else. Concentrate when you're ready, give me a sign. After 1 hour, the student gave the sign. Can you see the bird in the tree? What tree? Said the student. Can you see the bird? Oh, I can see the bird, stupid man. Pushed him aside and gave the bow and arrow to the third student. 2 hours, the third student concentrated. Before he gave a sign, he was one with the target. Can you see the bird on the tree? Said the master. What tree? Can you see the bird? What bird? Said the student. And the master intrigued, well, what can you see? What I can see, said the student, is one eyeball. Shoot. And it went right through the target. And it's a very good simile, because that's what concentration is, just like the television. Those students, they're focusing on the target, the left eyeball. If you focus long enough, the tree disappears. You're still focusing on the left eyeball, the rest of the bird disappears. And all you're left is to focus your attention. Example, if you just look at my nose and focus on my nose. Really focus on my nose and don't move your attention away. After a while, so the seat underneath me disappears. And the wall behind me is gone. And they keep on focusing on my nose, and my ears disappear, my mouth disappears, eyes have gone, and all you're left with is the nose. That's actually meditation. You start with, you're looking for the breath. All these other things on the outside, after a while they all disappear. All the sounds of people outside you, you may have already experienced that. Sometimes you're aware of people shuffling outside of you. But after a while, you're just aware of your body. And your awareness has gone in. And you don't even know what's happening outside. You don't even know what's happening in the past and the future. That's all disappeared. Just got present moment. After a while, you go into the breath and the whole body's disappeared. You can't feel any itches in your nose or aches in your knees. You've gone centering, centering, centering. If you go just onto the breath, you can't even know any thoughts. The thoughts have disappeared off the screen. If you go to the center of the thoughts, that's where the beautiful nimittas are. And after a while, the thoughts are completely gone. You've just got a nimitta left. They've fallen off the edge of the screen. And right in the middle of that nimitta is this beautiful jhana. And even the lights have all gone. Just bliss, that's all. This is just like watching the eyeball of the bird. Focusing in the center and all these other things, they fall off the screen. Letting go, letting go, letting go. In this meditation, using that simile, if you're trying to focus on anything, if it's the breath, say, make sure the breath is in the center of the screen. The center of your focus. The thoughts, they can be there as well. But if you're really focusing on the breath, after a while the thoughts will fall off the edge of your screen. You'll just be left with the breath. The mistake which meditators make is they put the thoughts in the center of their screen and then the breath falls off the edge. They think the thoughts are more important or the pain in the body is more important. So what is most important to you, you always put in the center of the screen. Just maintain your attention there with happiness as the glue, and all these other things will fall away. You've experienced for yourself this path of meditation, the wonder of these deep stages of meditation and the beauty of them. Sometimes people ask me this question, can everybody get to such deep stages of meditation? Or do you have to be like a monk or a nun? Do you have to be a special monk or a nun born sort of with jhanas? And the answer is no. The only people who can't get these stages are people who've killed their mother or killed their father, who have committed a schism in the Sangha, killed an arahat. These are what the Buddha called abhavapugala. Has anyone done any of those? If you haven't, it means that you can get into jhanas. It means you can get full enlightenment.
Is it done in this lifetime or a previous lifetime?
Now. Oh, what, killing your parents? No, previous lifetime. This lifetime. If it's in a previous lifetime, it's all finished with. God. So as long as you haven't done it in this lifetime, then you're okay. Remember, even Angulimala. You could get enlightenment and jhanas and serial killer. So, the point is here, I'm giving you confidence. It can be done. It's possible. Other people have done it. Why not you? Follow instructions and you'll get there. People only fail when they don't follow instructions. People in the West are really strange creatures. They buy a new microwave. And they plug it in first, so when it goes bang, only when it goes bang, they start reading the instructions. It was a bit late then. So you've got the instructions now. Understand those instructions, and then follow them. Then it'll work. Yes, sir? Have a question?
Yeah.
That's a special word, abhavapugala. It just means like incapable people. It's just the karma is so strong that it prevents such deep attainments. Just it's eventually becomes a remorse inside of you which doesn't allow you just to to get to such deep stages. Just psychologically, the block is too strong. You can still get very close, but not that far. But this is what we can all do. Is there any other questions anyone has? Yeah?
To bring happiness in the present moment, do you actually think about it?
You look for it. So, first of all, suggest the possibility to yourself that whatever you're experiencing now, there is some happiness there. That is on the supermarket shelf. So, the same way I said, look, it's on the shelf, it's in the supermarket there. Then you go looking up and down the aisles until you see it. When you see it, oh, there it is. And once you know where it is, you can always go back there every time. So find out. What do you do actually to find happiness? Do you actually think about this? Or what is actually the process to see happiness in the meditation? And to suggest the possibility that there is happiness, like in the present moment, there is happiness in the silence, there's happiness in the breath, there's happiness on my meditation cushion. Once you have that possibility there, then the mind can actually look for it, and once it looks for it, it will see it. And once it's found it, then you're home and dry, you'll be able to find it again. And this is not just with meditation, other things you have to do in your life. Sometimes there's things you have to do which, if you're not careful about, you don't want to do. Now, I don't want to write a letter to, you know, this is my uncle. Don't like the man. But if you start to think like that, it gets very difficult. So you start changing the perception around. And just what a wonderful thing you can do for your uncle. And just how that you can have fun writing a letter, put in a few jokes. When I was a school teacher, I only set one examination. So it's only, I was a school teacher for 1 year. And I set one examination in mathematics. It's the only examination I've ever set for kids. And I put a joke in it. It's really good. It's only like 3rd or 4th year high school or something. And I remember the joke. No, it's only a sort of silly joke. It was like, you know, these math questions that, you know, A and B are standing 100 metres apart and they're looking. I said, two school teachers, sit still and be quiet. We're looking somewhere. And just a little pun on words there. But I put that in the paper and the headmaster approved it and published it. And I was invigilating. You know, the master who actually sits on the top there watching everyone, they're not cheating. Well, I couldn't wait till some of these students actually read the examination paper. And they went in there just like any student. They were just so nervous. And, you know, going into an examination, and I was looking at one student. He wasn't a sort of a bright student, but he was okay. And he was just so nervous and so worried. And he was reading his paper. And then he looked at me, because he knew I'd said the paper. And I gave him this big smile, and he smiled back. And that was it. His nerves had gone. And he did really well. So it was lovely, actually, putting some fun into an examination paper. And, of course, once they saw the joke there, and they laughed, it did what it's supposed to do, relax everybody. And then they actually did much better in examination. So I think we should have a joke in every examination paper. So kids don't get so too nervous and stressed out. So see the happiness in what you're doing. Even in funeral services. That's part of my job as a monk, to lead funeral services. And I sort of put happiness into those as well. I tell a joke. I think many of you have heard my funeral joke. This is a lot of things with jokes. They make people laugh, but it's also there's some truth behind it as well. That's why it's funny. There's two old people, and one of them died, and like many people, been married together for many, many years. When one died, the other one, either through loneliness or whatever, she died a couple of days later. So they died within days of each other. So as it happened, they appeared in heaven together. And they were met by this angel. You've heard this one. this angel took them to this beautiful mansion on the cliffs overlooking the ocean. This I saw in the refectory, the canteen here, that this place cost 2.4 million. And this was a mansion which was even more beautiful than this place. And on cliffs, like in this world, it would cost tens of millions of dollars. And the angels took this old couple and said, because of all of your good deeds, this mansion is for you for the rest of eternity. Enjoy it. And the man took one look at this and said, this is worth a lot of money. The council rates must be enormous. And the angel said, he said, you don't have to pay rates up in heaven. And he took them inside, and there was many rooms in this mansion, and each room had a different type of furniture. Some antique furniture, some modern furniture, and there were digital TVs and CDs, and it was amazing just what they had in there. And he gave him his card and said, that's my email address there, said the angel. Anything you don't like, email me, and I'll change your furniture straight away. And the man looked at all that furniture and said, this is expensive. The insurance premium for this house. How can we afford that? And the angel had to explain to him, there are no thieves up in heaven, and even if there were, you wouldn't need to pay insurance. It's all free. And he took them downstairs where there was a triple garage. And there in the triple garage was a gleaming white Mercedes, just for a runabout. Next to that was a stretch Rolls Royce limo. And the third car was a red Ferrari with a sunroof. And he'd always wanted to have a Ferrari sports car. And the angel told him that up in heaven there's no speed cameras. But even so, the man said, the registration on these three cars must be wrong. Well, the angel rolled his eyes and said, there's no registration, no fines up here. This is like Christian day. You can't die twice. Even if you have a crash, you'll still be here. And he then opened the garage doors. On the opposite side of the road to the mansion was an 18-hole golf course. And before he was sick, he loved his golf. He would be out in the greens as often as he could. And the angel pointed to this immaculate course and said, this course over here has been designed by Greg Norman himself. And he said, and there's no waiting. Whenever you want to go and play there, I'll arrange for you just to go off and play. And the man looked at the clubhouse and said, this is an expensive club. The fees must be enormous. And the angel did one more roll of his eyes and said, listen, sir, he said, you don't have to pay anything up in heaven. No fees, no insurance, no registration, no rates. And especially you can drive your car whenever you want. You can go and play golf whenever you want. All free. And then the angel left them. And after a few seconds after the angel left them, the man started scolding his wife. He was so angry at her. And she couldn't understand why he was so upset. And when she had a chance to say something, she said, why are you angry at me? So we've got this wonderful mansion, we've got this beautiful furniture, you've got a sports car, you always wanted a sports car up in where we just came from, and you've got a golf course right across the road. You should be the happiest man. Why are you angry at me? And he looked at her with complete disgust and said, if it wasn't for your health food, I could have been up here years ago. There's actually a little bit of dharma in that, but I tell that at funerals just to make people happy. And the first time I told that at a funeral service, sort of I remember the expression on the funeral director's face. He was so worried. But then when everyone else started laughing, that he lightened up, and people came up to me afterwards and said, you know, the one who died, he said, thank you so much. He would have wanted that to happen. He'd have enjoyed that so much. And every time I told that joke since, no one ever complains. Because when you die, do you want people to hear a nice joke and laugh? Or would you like them to be sad? Because we want to be sent off respectfully. There's also a time for happiness as well, to celebrate a life rather than mourn a death. So you can actually bring happiness even to the most unexpected places. And that's great for children. I was saying this the other day. I've given so many funeral services. And I've been doing that when my predecessor, Ajahn Jaco, was there. He still kept on sending me to do the funeral services. He was doing other things. That was my speciality. And there's so many funerals. One thing which really concerned me was to see children coming to the funeral and being so ill at ease and so concerned, because they came there completely relaxed, but when they saw everyone else grieving and crying, they didn't know what to do, and they were so afraid that mummy and daddy and all their relations were hurting so much. They didn't know why. And they learnt from the example of their parents to grieve and to fear death. But those who come into my funeral services, they come there and they won't be afraid. And they realise there's an alternative to grieving. Children follow their adults. And I've seen that fear on their faces, and it's rotten to see. You know, there's so much pain there, and they're being brought into a painful place, and they don't know why. So anyway, that's how you can bring happiness into even the most strange places, and also how it can be so wonderful for society. So anyway, that's supposed to be just on meditation, on funerals. So that's bring happiness into your life, and bring happiness into the meditation. Of all things, that's the key to deep meditation. Perceiving happiness at each of one of these stages. You cannot force the mind. But if you bring up happiness, the mind will go all by itself. Okay, that's enough for today.